star turned white. The mace descended the steps, focusing his attention on the Holy Father. "You will not blackmail me with threats, nor will you distract me from the Queen's agenda. Don't send any more of this nonsense to my door. The next priest to set foot in here may not fare so well. And you, Borwin? You never want to be in my sight again." Isha felt as though her heart would burst. Maman and Wen had always defended her from Dar when they could, but it was different to have someone outside their family do so. If it had been permissible to hug the mace, she would have done. For she loved him suddenly, with the sort of fierce love she had never felt for anyone but her mother.
"Come, Brother Borwin," the Holy Father commanded. "It's just as I have always said. The Glynn crown drowns in its own pride. God knows of this injustice, but we will take your case to the public courts also, and expose this place for what it is."
"You may try," the mace replied evenly. "But beware, Your Holiness. Borwin's children are hardly his only accusers."
"No one has accused him of anything, Lord Regent."
"I accuse him."
The words were out of Isha's mouth before she could stop them. The eyes of the crowd were on her, and she wished more than anything that she could take it back.
"Did you say something, child?"
the Holy Father asked. His voice was honey-sweet, but his eyes glared. Strangely, this forced Isha to speak again. She thought that each word would be worse than the last, but once started, she found, relieved, that the opposite was true. The first words had been the hardest to say, and everything afterward came easier, as though a dam had broken inside her throat.
"I was 3 or 4 years when you started."
She fought hard to meet Dar's eyes, but could only focus on his chin.
"You went after Myrne at the same age. We finally had to hide under the floor to get away from you."
Isha heard her own voice rising in distress, but now it was like running down a hill, arms spinning like pinwheels. She couldn't stop.
"Always pushing, Dar, that's you, and you wouldn't leave us alone. That's what I remember best."
"Lies,"
the Holy Father snapped.
"It's not," she screamed. "It's true, and you just don't want to hear it."
"Hellcat," the mace said gently, and she stopped, drawing a thick, angry breath. "You're not in trouble, child, but I want you to go now. Corin, take her to her mother." Corin tugged gently at her arm, and after a moment, Isha went with him. She snuck a last look back and found an ocean of eyes still upon her. Dar remained beside the Holy Father, his face red with anger.
"Are you all right?"
Corin asked her in a low voice. Isha didn't know how to answer. She felt sick. Behind her, she heard the mace tell the two men to get out.
"Isha?"
Corin asked.
"I embarrassed the captain."
"No, you didn't,"
he replied, and she was grateful to hear his business-like tone.
"You did a useful thing. The Arvath won't dare put your father in front of a public judge now. Too many people were here."
"Everyone will know."
The thought seemed to scald Isha.
"The Caden won't care.
Corin remarked casually, and Isha halted.
Why do you say that?
I saw your face, girl. I know we're going to lose you one day. But grey cloak or red, do yourself a favor. Don't let your past govern your future.
Is it that easy?
No. Even the captain struggles with it. Every day.
A killer of children, Isha remembered. Maman was there suddenly, her arms open, and everything inside Isha seemed to mercifully collapse. She had been ready to kill Dar, ready for years. But now she was amazed to find that she had done something even more difficult. She had spoken aloud.
Tyler did not believe in hell. He had decided long ago that if God wanted to punish them, there was infinite opportunity right here. Hell would be superfluous. But if there was a hell on earth, Tyler had certainly found it. He and Seth were tucked into an alcove, a hidden recess deep within a tunnel, buried in the bowels of the earth. They had squeezed in here through a tiny crevice in the stonework. The floor and walls, lit only by the tiny flickering match in Tyler's fingers, were covered with mould. In the last moment before the match died, Tyler saw that Seth was looking worse than ever today. His cheeks, hectic with fever, and corneas yellowed with infection. Tyler had not looked at Seth's wound in several days, but if he did, he knew that he would see the red streaks climbing up Seth's belly toward his chest. When they had first escaped the Arvath, Tyler had taken Seth to a doctor, using most of the money he had saved. But the man was not a real doctor, and though he had given Seth something to ease his pain for a few days, he had not been able to stop the progress of the infection. The match guttered, and not a moment too soon, for now Tyler heard the sound of running footsteps, several pairs in the tunnel outside.
"The East Branch!" a man panted. "To the East Branch, and we can meet up in the road!"
"They're Caden, I know it!" another man said, his voice weak with fear. "They're coming!"
"What would Caden want down here? There's no money for them."
"All of you, the East Branch, quickly!"
The footsteps took off running again. Tyler leaned back against the wall of the recess, his heart pounding. He and Seth were already in a great deal of trouble. But if there really were Caden down here, their problems would multiply. In the early days of their flight, Tyler had gone up to the surface several times to trade coin for food and clean water, and it had not taken long to hear the news. The Arvath had placed bounties on them both. Tyler and Seth had long since discarded their Arvath robes, but even in layman's clothes, they no longer felt safe above ground. Tyler had not been out of the tunnels for more than 2 weeks, and their food supply was nearly gone.
"Ty," Seth asked in a whisper, "do you think they've come for us?"
"I don't know," Tyler replied. He had thought they were safe down here, but that safety brought its own price. In his trips through the tunnels, Tyler had seen many things, and as he came to understand what this labyrinth really was, he had begun to lapse back into the spiritual darkness that had gripped him during his final few weeks in the Arvath.
"God, why do you allow this? This world is yours. Why do you suffer these people to remain?"
Not surprisingly, he received no answer. He knew he must get Seth out of here, and soon. He had been looking for a subterranean route to the keep. Surely the mace must have used such a route to slip in and out of the Arvath unnoticed for his reading lessons. But Tyler was afraid to venture too far from the safety of their crevice. The price on Seth was only 1,000, but on Tyler's last trip topside, the bounty on his own head had stood at £5,000. No Caden would allow such an opportunity to slip through his fingers. From the gossip Tyler had picked up in a shadowy pub, he knew that his bounty also included his possessions. And this told Tyler that while the Holy Father surely wanted them both dead, and would pay good money to be able to send Tyler to judgment himself, his primary interest was not Tyler or Seth, but the polished cherrywood box that Tyler kept in his satchel. Tyler longed to take it out and open it again. But they could not afford to waste any more matches. They were down to their last packet. All the same, he could not help holding the satchel close, feeling the comforting edges of the box inside. After several weeks in the tunnels, Tyler had pieced together some of this business. The tear crown had not been seen since Queen Alyssa died. She must have gifted it to the church, an odd move for a monarch who did not attend services more than once a year, but Alyssa would not be the first to have found Jesus at her deathbed. Tyler had never met the Glynn Queen's mother, but she was accounted the sort of woman who might attempt to buy her way into heaven. The crown was undoubtedly valuable, made of solid silver and sapphire, but its value to Tyler went far beyond money. This crown had sat on the heads of every ruler since Jonathan Tyr, and had anchored many bloody battles of succession. It was rumored to have magical properties as well, though Tyler thought that was little more than fancy. To him, the crown was an artifact, a witness to the wild, brawling, extraordinary history of the Tyr, and Tyler could no more be careless with such an artifact than he could leave Seth behind. Besides, he had a promise to keep. The thought of the woman, Maya, nearly wrenched him in half. She had given him the crown, and he had left her there, sitting in front of the table of drugs. He could not have taken her with him, or the game would have been up. He knew this, but the knowledge brought him no peace. Anders was not one to spare the rod, and Tyler could not imagine what fate had befallen Maya after his escape. If nothing else, he meant to keep his promise and deliver the crown to the queen. But he could hardly do that down here. Footsteps pounded on the stone above Tyler's head, causing him to shudder. It might be the Caden, or another group of the lost and damned souls Tyler had seen down here. But the footsteps continued, many of them, and Tyler could not help thinking of another piece of information he had heard in the pub. Mobs now roamed the streets of New London, carrying swords and carpentered crucifixes, praising God and threatening violence to all who would not do the same. There was nothing explicit tying these mobs to God's church, and yet Tyler smelled the Holy Father's stink all over them. He would have bet his Bible that these people took their orders from the Arvath. It was a good church once, Tyler thought, and that was true. After the Tyr assassination, God's church had helped to keep order. The church had worked with the first Raleighs, kept William Tyr's colony from scattering to the four winds. In the second century after the crossing, an enterprising preacher named Dennis had seized on Catholicism, recognizing the great value of theatricality and ritual in capturing imaginations. Dennis had overseen the design and construction of the Arvath, a life's work that had drained the church coffers and made the man old before his time. Dennis had died only 3 days after the final stone was laid, and the church now recognized him as the first true Holy Father. But there had been plenty of men before him, guiding God's church along the same path. Tyler, who had gathered as much oral history as he could, knew that his church was far from perfect. But not even the darkest chapter in its history approached the state of the Arvath now. Of course, the Holy Father would not have dared to do any of this with the Queen in residence. Anders feared Queen Kelsey, feared her so greatly that not so long ago he had handed Tyler a vial of poison and ordered him to a terrible purpose. The Queen had surrendered herself to Mortmain. That news had been impossible to miss, even in Tyler's briefest trips to the surface, and the Mace was in charge of the kingdom. But the people of the Tierling did not love the Mace, only feared him, and fear was not nearly so dangerous. In the Queen's absence, the Holy Father was emboldened. "She must come back," Tyler thought, almost in the form of a prayer. "She must." New footsteps echoed in the tunnel outside, and Tyler pressed back against the wall. Several men ran by the tiny opening, but they made no sound beyond their steps, and even through the wall, Tyler could sense the military efficiency that underlay their movements, all of them unified in purpose. "Caden," his mind whispered. But in search of what? Were they here for Tyler and Seth? Or someone else? It hardly mattered. All it would take was one sharp pair of eyes to spot the narrow opening in the tunnel wall, and they would be discovered. The footsteps passed without slowing, and Tyler relaxed. Seth huddled against him, shivering, and Tyler wrapped his arms around his friend. Seth was dying, slowly and painfully, and Tyler could do nothing for him. He had helped Seth to escape the Arvath, but what good was escape to them now? All hands were turned against them. "Dear God," Tyler prayed, though he felt certain that the words were going nowhere but around and around the dark chasm of his mind. "Dear God, please show us your light." But there was nothing. Only darkness, an endless drip of water, and, somewhere nearby, the fading footsteps of assassins. Chapter 5 Tears Land. The mistake of Utopia is to assume that all will be perfect. Perfection may be the definition, but we are human, and even into Utopia we bring our own pain, error, jealousy, grief. We cannot relinquish our faults, even in the hope of paradise. So to plan a new society without taking human nature into account is to doom that society to failure. The Glyn Queen's words, as compiled by Father Tyler. William Tyr was deeply worried about something. Katie was sure of it. Even after almost a year of working with him, she didn't know Tyr well. He wasn't a man one came to know, for he guarded himself too closely. Katie didn't think even Mum completely understood him. Some days, Katie felt as though she could almost see the thing weighing on Tyr, bowing his shoulders and making him age, and because he was worried, Katie was worried as well. She was seated on the ground, in the middle of the belt, the narrow strip of dense woodland that bordered the northern side of town. The tree cover was thick here, allowing only rare patches of sunlight to dapple the dry grass. "Push!" Tyr barked,
His footing is weak, you see. This is the moment when you use the weight of your body to close on him and put him down. Get a man solidly beneath you with a knife in your hand and you've already won.
Katie wrapped her arms around her knees, trying to concentrate on the sparring area in front of her, where Gavin and Virginia were locked, straining. Each had a knife in hand, but right now weapons were secondary. This lesson was about leverage. Katie wasn't fantastic with a knife, and she didn't have the size to overpower anyone. But she was one of the quickest among them, and she had an easier time trusting her own body, her reflexes and balance. Virginia was taller and better muscled, but she couldn't find the place to push. And a few seconds later, Tyr called a halt and began to point out what she had missed. Virginia looked disgruntled, but Katie didn't think it would be counted against her. There were 9 of them in training here. Katie, Virginia Warren, Gavin Murphy, Jess Alcott, Jonathan Tyr, Leah Williams, Ben Howell, Alain Garvey, and Morgan Spruce. They all had different strengths, but Virginia's was the most valuable. She feared absolutely nothing. Katie had learned much in the past year, but fearlessness couldn't be taught, and she coveted the quality.
"Virginia, sit and watch. See if you can spot it this time."
Tyr snapped his fingers.
"Alain, have a go at Gavin."
Alain got up from his spot across the circle and approached Gavin warily. The two were good friends, but Alain was the weakest fighter among the group, and Gavin knew it. A gleam of overconfidence had entered his eyes. Katie shook her head. Gavin was a good fighter, but he tended toward arrogance, and it had gotten him in trouble more than once.
"Shrink your size, Garvey," Aunt Maddie called from beside Tyr, "or he'll knock you flying."
Alain tucked his shoulders toward his chest and pulled a knife from the sheath at his waist. Their knives were crude, little more than pointed spears with handles, the same tools that workers used to slaughter cattle. But Katie had overheard Mum talking to Aunt Maddie, who said that Tyr had made them all real knives. Fighting knives. Such weapons had to be made in secret and carried in secret. Sometimes it seemed to Katie that, in the long year since she had sat on the bench with William Tyr, her life had filled up with secrets, like a pot beneath a leak. But they would receive the knives when they were ready. Katie could barely wait. Alain was taller than Gavin, but Gavin was the best knife handler among them, and he could move like a tree lizard to boot. Within only a few seconds, he had maneuvered behind Alain and grabbed his knife hand, wrapping Alain's wrist over his knee purposefully and methodically, trying to make Alain drop his knife.
"Hold!"
Tyr called, stalking into the ring. Mum came with him, her eyes snapping with disapproval.
"What would happen in a real fight, Gavin?"
Mum demanded.
"I would have kept hold of him,"
Gavin replied, his voice toneless.
"I would have broken his wrist and then busted his knee."
"Failure means little in this ring,"
Tyr told Alain.
"But in the real world, the real fight, failure is swift death. This is a thing to understand and remember."
From the corner of her eye, Katie saw Virginia nodding grimly. They were friends of a sort, though Virginia was a bit too fierce to ever be a real friend. Last week, at the big argument over the distribution of the harvest, Virginia had actually grabbed Mr. Ellis by the throat. And if several adults hadn't pulled her off, Katie was quite sure that Virginia would have strangled him with her bare hands. In the town of Katie's childhood, there had been no fighting. If people had problems, they argued them out. Now it felt as though there was an incident every week, and Katie often wondered whether they were training for peacekeeping, whether this was the trouble that William Tyr had foreseen. Next to Virginia, Jonathan Tyr was staring at the two figures in the center of the ring, his eyes clocking and learning. Everything about Jonathan was William Tyr in duplicate, except for his eyes, large and dark. Lily's eyes. Katie had often noted the resemblance. Jonathan was neither a good nor a bad fighter. Katie had beaten him before, though he was a year older than she was. But that hardly mattered. Every moment of his life, Jonathan was learning. Katie could see it, see those dark eyes recording information and sending it to be processed back in the enormous room that was Jonathan's brain. Room? Hell, it was an entire house.
"Gavin, swap out. Lear, you have a go at Alain."
Lear scrambled up from his place, and Katie almost saw Alain groan. Lear was not the best fighter among them, but he got the most respect because he was smart. His father, who had died in the crossing, had been one of William Tyr's most trusted people, and Mum often said that Lear had gotten his father's brains. He was apprenticing with old Mr. Welland, the town historian, and Lear was working on his own history of the town. Not the crossing. None of them knew enough about that period, and the answers they got from adults were maddeningly vague. But according to Gavin, Lear meant to chronicle the history of the town for his entire lifetime before publishing the document at his death. No one wanted to fight a boy who was capable of thinking so long-term. "Close the circle a bit," Mum ordered. "Less room for error." They all scooted inward. "Go." Lear circled Alain, who stood nearly frozen. He was a weakness among them, and Katie resented that weakness. There was no room for it here. "That's Roe talking," she scowled, wishing she could force her mind to be quiet. There was an almost schizophrenic quality to her thoughts these days. It seemed as though each discrete idea could be categorized as belonging to either Roe or Tyr. Alain was not a great fighter, no. But, like so many crossing children, he had other skills, particularly a phenomenal gift for sleight of hand. You never played Alain at cards, not for anything more than bragging rights. He had won several skeins of Katie's best marled yarn before Katie learned to stop betting. Each fall, at the Harvest Festival, Alain would put on a magic show that impressed the adults and absolutely thrilled the smaller children. He might not be much of a fighter, but Katie recognized the great value of having so many different people in one community, each of them singular, each with gifts and faults and interests and oddities. They created a tapestry, all of them, just as the characters in a book might. It was the lesson of the town, taught to children before they could even walk. You are special. Everyone is special. But you are not better. All are valuable. But Roe couldn't quantify the value of that tapestry. Katie often tried to explain it to him, but she wasn't sure she was getting through. Roe had no patience for inefficiency. And sometimes his thoughts would entwine with Katie's, strangling Tyr's voice, killing it off. Lear stopped circling and moved in, quick and silent. In moments he had slipped behind Alain and wrapped his arms around his friend's neck, headlocking him.
"Hold."
William Tyr stood with crossed arms, his eyes pinned on Alain. Those eyes were not without pity. But they were cold, and Katie suddenly knew that Alain was on thin ice.
"That's enough for today. All of you go to your regular apprenticeships."
Lear released Alain, who stumbled away, rubbing his throat. Lear placed a hand on his back, and Alain smiled good-naturedly, but there was grimness there as well. Katie felt certain that he, too, knew he was on some sort of probation. Gavin began to give him a hard time, but that was Gavin, so convinced of his own gifts that he sometimes tipped into cruelty by accident. Gavin had asked her to the summer picnic last year, and even though he was good-looking, Katie had said no. There was something relentless in Gavin, ready to crush everything on the path to his objective. Katie didn't trust him to put anything before himself. "Come on now," her mind mocked. "Is Ro any better?" "No, but Ro knew he was worse, harbored no illusions about himself. That made a huge difference. Ro might be unkind, but Gavin was a fool. He didn't even like to read." Tyr, Aunt Maddie, and Mum left the clearing, heading west back up toward town. Mum nodded to Katie as they went, a subtle signal that Katie had done well today. Gavin, Howell, Alain, and Morgan disappeared into the trees, heading eastward, around the hill and south, down to the cattle farm. Jess went downhill toward the lumber site, and Virginia followed. She was part of a large group that was just beginning to explore and map the vast land outside the town. Tyr's land, they were calling it now, though Katie knew from Mum that William Tyr didn't like that at all. They all had apprenticeships to camouflage these sessions. Even Jonathan Tyr had a day job working at the dairy. But no apprenticeship could match Tyr's lessons. He was teaching them to fight, but that was only half of it. In some indefinable way, Katie felt that Tyr was also teaching them, not by word, but by example, to be better. Better people, better members of the community. During their sessions, Ro's voice was still present in Katie's head, but muted. In Ro's world, Alain would have been booted a long time ago. But Ro's ideas of exceptionalism, his dog-eat-dog vision of the world, these things seemed to have no place in this clearing. Katie waited a minute before she got up, brushing the prickly grass from the bottom of her pants. She could afford to be a bit late to the sheep farm. She worked hard, and Mr. Lynn, who was in charge of the spinners and dyers, thought she practically walked on water. She could probably ditch for a week before he would say something. Across the clearing, Jonathan Tyr was still sitting on the ground, staring straight ahead. His face was clouded and dull, almost sleepy. And Katie walked away, leaving him alone. Jonathan was so damn weird. Even in a community that valued individuals, Katie wasn't sure what place Jonathan held. He was his father's son, and that could have given him a great status. But Jonathan would accept none of the adulation the town longed to shower upon him. He didn't seem to know how to handle it. He spent all of his free time in the library, curled up with a pile of books in a dark recess on the second floor. Even in their practice sessions, Jonathan was isolated, shut out of the jocular familiarity that the rest of them enjoyed, that happy sense of group elite that defined them. He was odd, simply odd, and Katie's first impulse was to simply leave him alone. But as she reached the edge of the clearing, her steps slowed until she came to a halt. Mum's voice was in her head, the voice of Katie's childhood, the voice that said when you saw your neighbour in trouble, no matter how much you disliked him or disagreed with him, you stopped. You helped. Jonathan Tyr didn't look at all well. With an exasperated sigh, Katie turned and marched back to him. "Are you all right?" Jonathan didn't answer, merely kept staring straight ahead. Katie squatted down on her haunches and stared at his face, realizing that the look she had mistaken for dullness was really fixation, as though Jonathan saw something in the distance. Katie looked behind her, but there was only the wall of trees on the far end of the clearing. "Jonathan?" She snapped her fingers in front of his eyes, but he didn't blink. His pupils were dilated, and Katie wondered if he was having an attack of some kind, if she should call someone. But the rest of the group had disappeared. Even the sounds of their passage had gone, and there was only the melody of the woods, birdsong and the low rustle of the tree branches, as early afternoon wind sighed through their leaves. Slowly, hesitantly, Katie reached out and placed her hand on Jonathan's shoulder. He jumped, but his pupils did not contract. And when he turned to look at her, his gaze was just as blank and distant as before, staring straight through her, making Katie shudder. "It's gone bad," he whispered. "Bad town, bad land. You and me, Katie. You, me, and a knife." At the last word, Katie jumped, her hand reaching automatically for the knife at her waist. Jonathan reached out and grasped her wrist with ice-cold fingers, the edges of his mouth lifting in a ghastly grin. "We tried, Katie," he whispered. "We did our best." With a low cry, she tore her wrist free. Jonathan blinked, his pupils contracting in the sun-dappled light. He stared at her, brow furrowed. "Katie?" She scooted backward. Her heart was still racing, and she didn't want to be so close to him. She felt danger coming from him, radiating off him, almost like heat. "You were dreaming," she ventured. "Dreaming," her mind replied mockingly. "He was in a trance, some kind of trance, like Annie Fowler gets sometimes when they ask her to tell tomorrow's weather." But Annie would merely close her eyes for a moment before predicting the weather, usually correctly. What happened to Jonathan had been something else entirely. It was almost like...
"Is practice over?"
Jonathan asked. "Yes." She straightened, then offered him a hand. She would pull him to his feet, and that would be the end of it. She had fulfilled her neighborly requirement for today. She would get out of here, go down to the sheep farm, dye some yarn, and forget about this entire creepy scene. Instead, she felt her mouth open and say, "What did you see?" His expression drew inward.
"What do you mean?"
She pulled him up. "Your father goes into trances. Mum's told me about them. You were in one too. What did you see?"
"You can't tell anyone about this."
"Why not? It's not my fault you decided to do it right in the middle of practice." He grabbed her shoulders, and Katie tensed, suddenly realizing that he was nearly a foot taller than she was. She reached for her knife, but before she could pull it free, Jonathan released her and backed away.
"I'm sorry," he said stiffly. "But I don't want anyone to know."
"Why not?" Katie asked, bewildered. "I would love to have the sight. I didn't get any gifts from the crossing."
Jonathan gave her a measuring look. "All my life, people have been watching me, waiting for me to become my father in miniature. And that's fine. I understand why they do it. But dynasties are dangerous. Whoever they elect to lead this town next, it shouldn't be simply because he's someone's son. They'll make a better decision if they think I'm like everyone else."
"Isn't it a little hard to hide?"
"Not really.
I spend most of my time alone. Katie looked down, embarrassed. She had always assumed that Jonathan's isolation was merely a function of social awkwardness. It had never occurred to her that it might be self-imposed. Thinking of the snide comments that she and Roe had traded back and forth about him, she felt ashamed. "Don't," Jonathan said, making Katie jump. "It's the impression you were meant to get." Katie retreated, frightened again. Had he heard what she was thinking? Several teenagers in town had a little bit of that talent. Katie had overheard Mum and Aunt Maddie talking about it once. Mum said that William Tyr had ordered them not to talk about these things, not to make the crossing children feel singled out. Roe could do extraordinary things with fire. It was his gift, just as Ellie Bennett could find water and Matt Van Wy could make things vanish. Roe did not showcase his ability either. Only Katie, and perhaps Roe's mother, knew that this skill was what made Roe such a fine metalworker. Katie, who had been born nearly 2 years after the landing, had no such gifts, and had often envied them. But she sensed that the crossing children, with their little magics salted around the town like hidden eggs at the spring festival, were very different from Jonathan. Power seemed to surround him. Katie looked down and found that the hair on her arms was standing on end. She kept her hand on her knife. "I'm no danger to you," Jonathan told her. Maybe not, but there was danger in him all the same, and Katie struggled to analyze it. Hadn't she just been thinking that the town was a place where everyone was equally valuable, where all their gifts came together to make a tapestry? Equally valuable? What about William Tyr? Katie blinked. She wondered what Roe would say if he knew what she had discovered here, and the answer came back instantly. "We don't need another William Tyr." Yes, that was Roe's voice, but Roe hadn't been there that night, hadn't sat on the bench and felt Tyr's greatness, the majesty of him. Tyr had arranged with all of their mentors to shield this time, to pretend that they were all working at their apprenticeships when they were not. And so far, the story seemed to be holding. But secrecy from Roe was a different story entirely. He knew that Katie wasn't being entirely truthful, and it had created a tiny divide between them. Katie hated this divide, but could do nothing about it. Although she still chafed occasionally at the strictures of the town, its innate hypocrisy, she knew that she could never go against William Tyr. Tyr didn't want to be worshipped as a god or even a king. There was danger there, something innately hostile to the democracy he prized. But Katie worshipped him all the same. And now here was Tyr's son, the odd duck of Katie's school, a boy she had always dismissed as utterly unimportant, standing here with William Tyr's power flowing off him in waves. A new thought occurred to Katie, one she had never considered. What would happen to the town when William Tyr was gone? "Will you take your hand off your knife?" Jonathan asked. She did. Jonathan relaxed, sinking to his haunches, and Katie suddenly remembered that he was only a year older than she was. For a few moments there, the gap had felt like decades. "I won't tell anyone," she said. He looked up and smiled. Katie had to look away, for the smile was brilliant, almost blinding in its goodwill. For a moment, she wanted to beg his forgiveness. Again she thought of that night in her backyard, sitting beside Tyr on the bench and realizing that she would do whatever he might ask. The tears were dangerous people. But theirs was not a danger of knives.
Thank you, said Jonathan.
Katie looked at her watch. She should have been at the sheep farm long ago, but something in her still hesitated, and when she identified that hesitation, it stunned her. She was waiting to be dismissed.
Go,
Jonathan told her, and Katie stumbled toward the edge of the clearing. Her mind would not quite focus, and her skin was puckered with goose flesh. It was the way she imagined trees felt after being struck by a bolt of lightning. She looked back, but Jonathan had already vanished. Katie turned and continued on her way, cutting steadily eastward, looking for the path that wrapped around the slope, the path that would take her back to the hill road. She eventually found it, but that lightning-struck feeling persisted. What happened? She demanded, though she knew she would get no answers. What happened to me back there? She didn't know, but one fact at least had solidified in her mind. She now had another secret to keep. Not from the town, that was easy, but from Ro. Another secret to divide them. And Katie felt the wedge drive a bit deeper into her mind. Tyr and Ro. So distant now that they might as well have been on opposite sides of a ravine. And where did Katie plant her flag? I can be both, she insisted. But even in her mind her voice was shrill, the high, anxious tone of someone covering a lie. Tapping. Katie woke abruptly from a dream of flight and found herself in darkness. The tapping continued, and for a moment she felt her dream morph, smoothly and seamlessly as dreams often did, into something new. A poem Mum had read to her when she was young. There was a raven outside, tapping away, and Katie could not open her window. Only madness waited there. Another soft set of taps. She realized that she was awake, that the sound was real fingers on her window, a large board that Mum had built to swing outward on hinges. Unlike the glass windows in her books, this window was only opaque wood, and Katie could not see what was out there. Nothing, her mind whispered. Nothing good. Ignore it and go back to sleep. But the tapping could not be ignored. In fact, it was beginning to increase, both in speed and volume, and soon it would wake Mum. Katie took a deep breath, reminded herself that she was a fierce animal, drew the bolt, and cracked the window. Ro was crouched beneath the windowsill, his dark eyes peeping up at her in the moonlight. "Bundle up and come on." "Where?" she asked. "Out." "What time is it?" She fumbled on her bedside table for her watch. 2:30. Ro held up a black, shapeless mass. "I brought us cloaks. I figure in these we should be able to pass as grown-ups." Katie didn't move. Every instinct in her body told her not to go. Yet there was a terrible fascination in the darkness behind Ro. He could break the rules and not get in trouble. But Katie wasn't as brave. Ro smiled. "Why not? You know me, Katie. I never get caught." She drew back, suddenly chilled, remembering the moment that afternoon with Jonathan Tyr. Could anyone read her mind now? She looked at Ro suspiciously, wondering if he had been holding back on her all these years. "Did you—" "I know you, Rapunzel. When have we ever needed magic to read each other's minds?" That was true. Sometimes the two of them achieved such perfect simpatico that they didn't need to talk at all. "What are you afraid of, anyway?" Ro demanded, crossing both arms on her windowsill.
"Me?"
"No, not Ro, precisely." But Katie couldn't explain. As always, what Ro offered was dark and wild and off-limits. The night outside her window. If she got caught, out after curfew, her punishment wouldn't end with Mum. It would go all the way to William Tyr. He might even take her off the guard.
"Why are you even here?" she demanded. "What about Mia?"
Ro shrugged, an entire conversation that Katie read easily. He might be sleeping with Mia Gillon this week. But Mia would wait, just as all the women in town seemed to wait on Ro. He had his choice of beds, and he made good use of them. But none of the women mattered. Katie found the idea comforting. The magic circle that had surrounded the two of them since childhood was solid, far too solid to be broken by anyone as ridiculous as Mia Gillon. Ro leaned in even farther, dangling the cloak in front of her. "Last chance, Rapunzel." With fingers that were not quite steady, she took the cloak.
"I have to get dressed.
I'll be out front. Hurry up." Trembling, Katie closed the window. Her stomach had twisted into knots, as it always did when she knew she could get into trouble. She felt as though she might throw up.
"What are you doing?"
she whispered to herself, drawing on her thick wool pants and warmest shirt.
"Why are you doing this?"
There was no answer. Katie thought again of Jonathan Tyr, his father, Mum, books. But these were things of the daytime, and now it was night.
"So stupid,"
she whispered, swinging a leg over the windowsill.
"Stupid, stupid, stupid."
She dropped to the ground and swung the window closed behind her. The hinges screeched a bit, making her wince. Without the bolt shot, the wood would not lay flush, leaving a gap of perhaps half an inch. But there was no help for that. The grass under her window was wet with night dew, and she could already feel it beginning to soak through her thick wool shoes. But her feet seemed to carry her forward of their own accord, out into the lane in front of the house, where Ro waited silently, cloaked and hooded. He took her hand, and Katie felt an odd thrill course through her veins.
"Come on."
They hurried up the lane and then down toward the southern end of town. Mist had covered the hillside, obscuring all but the occasional brightly lit lamppost. Everything was quiet, and the silence brought home to Katie, as nothing else had today, the strange hybrid status of her age. Right on the cusp of growing up. All of the children were in bed. But here were she and Ro, neither children nor adults, darting through the streets without permission. Interlopers in a deep blue world. After a few moments, the lane began to slope downward for good. Katie had lost her bearings in the mist, but Ro seemed to know where they were going, for he tugged at her hand, leading her off the road and into the space between a cluster of houses. Katie didn't know how he could be so sure of their path. She couldn't see more than 5 feet ahead. Her shoes were soaked through, the tips of her toes going numb. The houses ended, and they were into the woods now. Trees and shrubs that Ro darted around, pulling Katie with him. The mist began to clear as they continued downward, and soon Katie was able to find her own footing. They were in the lower bend, the last section of town before the eastern slope went back into forest. Ro did his internship down here, at Jenna Carver's metal shop. and Katie soon realized that was their destination.
Ro, what?
Shh! Jenna's shop was a rickety wood building, unprotected from the relentless wind that battered the eastern slope. Katie assumed that the door would be locked, since Jenna had many people's valuables in there. But as they climbed the worn steps, Ro produced a key.
Where did you get that?
I duped it. Katie shook her head at the foolishness of her own question. Among many other metal items, Ro and Jenna also made locks and keys. Not many people locked their doors in town, but all of them had locks. Katie suspected that this oddity, like so many others, had something to do with the pre-crossing, but she could not be certain. All of the adults were the same, happy enough to talk about the crossing itself, though they were maddeningly vague about geography, or about world history. But the period immediately before the crossing, some 30 or 40 years, was a dark hole in the town's consciousness. Whatever had driven them all here, they had decided to bury it. She followed Ro inside the shop, then waited, shivering as he lit a lamp. "This had better be good, Ro. I'm freezing."
"It is," Ro replied, rummaging through a drawer in Jenna's desk. "Look here."
He held up a dark gemstone, its many facets gleaming. Even in the dim light, Katie had no trouble recognizing this stone as William Tears, the same one she had held in her fist more than a year before. But she stared at it as though it was new to her. "What is it?" she asked. Part of her felt sorrow, the same sorrow she experienced when she lied to Ro about where she had been in the afternoons. There were so many secrets now.
"It's William Tears," Ro replied. "He gave it to Jenna. Wants her to set it in a necklace with a silver setting. I'm not supposed to know."
"Then how do you know?"
"I eavesdropped," Ro replied, grinning.
Katie knew that grin well, but in this moment it struck her as almost grotesque. She didn't like seeing William Tears' sapphire in Ro's hand.
"That's what you dragged me out here to show me."
"It's not just any stone," Ro protested. "Here, take it."
Katie took it. She felt none of the sensations she remembered from that night on the bench. Only the cold heft of the thing, its many points biting into her palm. Ro stared at her eagerly, but after a moment his brow quirked.
"Don't you feel it?"
"Feel what?"
"Magic," Ro replied.
"Magic," Katie replied, her voice laced with sarcasm. "It's real magic, Katie. I can feel it when I hold it."
Katie threw him a disgusted look, but beneath the sadness at her own deception, she felt a sudden, deeper pain. Ro's enthusiasm wasn't false. Katie hadn't seen him this excited about anything in a long time. When he held the jewel, something happened to him. Magic, as he put it. Why wasn't anything happening for Katie? She squeezed the jewel tightly in her fist, but there was nothing, not even that warming tingle she remembered from the night on the bench with Tear. The jewel was an inert rock in her hand.
"What kind of magic?"
"It shows me things." Ro's eyes were bright with excitement. "The past, the crossing. I know what happened, Katie. I know why they kept it a secret."
He paused, waiting for her to ask what, but Katie did not. Anger bubbled inside her. Anger that began with a sticky, acid trickle she recognized as jealousy.
"Get real, Ro,"
she replied, turning away. Ro grabbed her arm. I'm not lying. I saw it.
Sure you did.
Part of Katie felt sick at this exchange, at lying once again to her oldest and best friend.